Proceeding of this case, we are ready to hear from petitioners.
And at least before that, we'll present arguments to the court.
May it please the court, Mr. Mercer. I'm Leighton Cornett, very much a country lawyer from Paris, Texas. Always happy to appear in Austin, and particularly my infrequent appearances before this court. I sort of consider Austin a second home since after spending several years here while I was in law school and then while I was in the legislature. So it's always a pleasure to come to Austin, either on business or pleasure.
Some of us were discussing, Mr. Cornett, what year were you in the legislature?
I was in the legislature. I was elected when I was 21, Judge Kilgarland. While I was in law school, I was in the 46th session of the legislature, 1939. Now, I hope you won't figure up that age that I have now attained by virtue of that information. This is a case in which I represent the petitioner and the appellant, Mark G. Mark G. was a young 20-year-old physically active man who was working out of Camel Soup there in Paris, Texas back on February the 8th of 1982, more than 6 years ago. He had been active physically, played football in high school. He had worked at a feed store and was working at heavy physical labor there at Camel Soup when two pallets came together on his leg and crushed the leg below the knee. The insurance company paid 125 weeks of disability compensation based on the fact that he was injured, did have a severe injury below the knee, but they claimed that was the extent of their liability by virtue of the fact that the injury was confined to the knee. The case was tried based on the theory that the injury to the leg extended into and affected the body generally. The jury went along with that, found such, and then also found total and permanent disability. The district court entered judgment based on that for total and permanent disability. The insurance company appealed to the Court of Appeals in Texarkana. The Court of Appeals in Texarkana reversed and rendered on a 2-1 decision.
Reversed and remanded.
I'm sorry?
Reversed and remanded, not rendered. Did you say rendered?
That's right. I'm sorry. You're right, Judge Gonzalez. Reversed and remanded based on the thing, and the only point of error that we have before this court is the fact the court said that there were two witnesses that were used in the trial of this case who had not been identified in interrogatories advanced to the plaintiff by the defendant, and that as a result of the use of this testimony, the case should be reversed and remanded because of the prejudicial effect of that testimony. Now, our contention is that the court committed error. And I hope to be very brief because I think I have covered pretty well our position in our brief, but we contend that this is a workman's compensation case, that the injured party testified, telling of his injuries and his inability to work, and that the pain in his back shortly after he got hurt and was in the hospital for 10 days, that his mother, who was a registered nurse, testified to pain in his back and his disability to work, that his aunt, who had taught school for 20 years, moved to Paris in April after he got hurt in February of 1982, and that he complained of pain in his back even back there at that time. So our contention is that under the many cases of even the Supreme Court and the lower courts, the testimony of the injured party, Mark G., and the testimony of his mother and his sister would justify a total and permanent disability verdict on the part of the jury. Now then, I would readily admit that in a case where we are contending that there is an extension of the injury into the body generally, that we need medical causation. And we have that in the testimony in this case. Dr. Jackson, orthopedic specialist in Dallas, testified that, yes, based...
Dr. Ruth Jackson.
I'm sorry?
Dr. Ruth Jackson.
Yes, sir. Testified that based on reasonable medical probability, the injury that he sustained to his crushed leg extended into and affected his body generally. So we made that medical causation. Now then, we contend that the two witnesses that testified, Dr. Emmett, who was the family physician of Mr. G., and his uncle, Mr. Milford, were totally cumulative, and that the testimony, just lay aside their testimony, there still would be sufficient testimony in this record to justify affirming the judgment of the court, affirming the verdict of the jury.
Mr. Cornett.
So, yes, sir.
The issue as I see it, Judge Cornelius writing for the Texarkana Court stated that under the prior writings of this court, Morrow versus H.B. and Yandell, that the burden was on you to show good cause as to why the witnesses that were not included in the interrogatory, since you failed to supplement, the burden was on you to show good cause, and since you did not show good cause, therefore there was error. Would you speak to that?
Yes, sir. The court totally failed to pass on this 100 decisions that I refer to, in my, at least 100 decisions that I refer to, Judge Gonzalez, in my brief, of cumulative error. In other words...
Well, but we didn't say anything about cumulative error. Yandell and Morrow was H.E.B.
No, sir, that's right.
Exclusion, your failure to supplement.
That's right, exactly. The court
did automatic.
Not, the court did not pass on cumulative error in those cases. That's right, exactly. So the question, as I see it, is... even assuming that the court erred in permitting the testimony of Dr. Emmett and Mr. Milford, is the court going to throw out this 100-year history of cumulative error? I don't think so. And I don't think the court has gone that far in these decisions construing Rule 215-5. And so that's the position that we take, sir. Now, Dr. Emmett, I've mentioned this in my brief. Dr. Emmett's deposition was taken by the defendant. Admittedly, I did not use his name in my answer to interrogatories, and I didn't supplement my interrogatories by using his name.
But you admit he's an expert witness?
I'm sorry?
And you admit that he's an expert
witness? Oh, yes, sir. He was a family physician.
What was the nature then? Deposition, was it a deposition on written questions, or was it
oral deposition? And I was present, and Mr. Mercer was present. But Dr. Emmett gave some information that was beneficial to me. The deposition was there in court. I used that portion. Now, I haven't found a case which passes on that point where the opposition takes the deposition of a witness and certain portions of that deposition are favorable to your cause, then do you still have to go back and supplement your interrogatory to say he's told something here that's favorable to me and I want to use it? I can't find anything on that particular point. But my contention is that here's a deposition that the defendant took laying up there on the bench, and then some part of it favorable to me, I ought to be able to use it without having said back under 14 days before the trial, or 30 days before the trial, that I expect to use certain portions of this deposition. So I think there's a little distinction in Dr. Emmett's deal there, where insofar as if I had called him, or it had been my deposition, and then running in the face of this rule on interrogatories. So it's my contention that cumulative evidence, legion of cases that this court and other courts have passed on through the years will relieve me of that responsibility. And I point out in my brief, and I point out to the court here, that we have ample testimony besides that found in Dr. Emmett's deposition. And I also point out it in my brief that Dr. Emmett, the sum and substance of his testimony was unfavorable to me. He specifically would not say that the injury to the leg extended into and affected the body generally. So the court, Judge Cornelius, in his opinion, is emphasizing the fact that Dr. Emmett's testimony, as given in his deposition, was so favorable that the jury could not have found total and permanent disability and an extension into the body general without Dr. Emmett's testimony. And the facts are to the contrary.
Let me ask you if you demonstrated good cause to the trial court to introduce these two witnesses.
No, sir.
Without having...
No, sir.
Do you think it's your burden to do so? Or do you think it's the other party's burden to negate good cause?
I think it's my burden to do so, Judge. But I think my position is that the cumulative effect of the test, if that had been all the testimony, I don't think there's any question about it.
You say it's harmless because it's cumulative.
Yes, sir.
Was this just an oversight on your part?
Probably was, Judge.
Did you
yes,
ever,
sir. Probably I mean, was.
Quasi irrelevant question. Did you ask for a continuum when you saw the error?
No, sir. No, sir.
Now I've got a relevant question. You asked for a reversal and rendition. If we agree with you, wouldn't we have to remand this to the Court of Appeals for them to look at whether this was harmless error, or do you think we can do this ourselves?
Judge, I think you can do it, but I'm frank to tell you that I'm a whole lot more expert in justice, peace court in Paris than I am in the Supreme Court of Texas, so that's just an offhand opinion of mine, which I don't have anything to base it on.
This accident happened 6 years ago.
6 years ago.
What has taken this case so long?
Number one, they paid him 125 weeks, weekly payments. And then when they stopped his payments in 1986, I believe it was, I filed my lawsuit. And then we finally tried it in December of 86. And so it's been in the appellate process since that time, Judge Robertson.
They were in Houston, that'd be 4 more years.
So, but anyhow, we feel that because it is a workman's comp case, because of the fact that the testimony of other testimony, and because of the fact the cumulative rule of this court and the other courts throughout at least 100 years of jurisdiction justify us in asking this court to reverse and either remand to the Court of Civil Appeals or reverse and render and uphold the jury verdict and the judgment of the district court in this case. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you. The court is now ready to hear argument from counsel for respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Mercy will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, I'm John Mercy from Texarkana. I used to like to stand up and tell the jury that I was a pretty fair country lawyer, but I think if I do that today, it'd be kind of embarrassment, since Mr. Cornett can outdo me at that. I came prepared today to argue this case basically in the face of Justice Gonzalez's question as to the application of the Morrow case and Rule 215, Section 5. I think there are a couple of facts that this court needs to be aware of with regard to this case and on the factual basis. One, that the injury occurred in February of 1982. It was a soft tissue injury to the man's leg below his knee. There were no broken bones. He was not placed in a cast. He was prescribed elevation. Once he left the hospital, he was prescribed elevation for his leg as treatment and given various blood thinners and painkilling type medications. He was off work for a period of time because of this. Then he returned to work. He paid compensation up to the time he returned to work. He worked for a period of a couple of months. He was laid off from that job because of seniority. He resumed drawing comp at that.
When did he go back to work? After how long?
The specific date?
Well, just an approximation.
I believe he was off a little over 7 months.
But your carrier paid 2 years.
Yes,
2 years and 2 months compensation.
Yes, sir. He went back to work, got laid off because of seniority, and for some reason they picked up comp payments when he was back off work. I can't explain it, but they did. They ended up paying the total of 125 weeks, which was the total amount for the loss of the use of leg loading. During the time periods that he was off work after the compensation payments had run out, he applied for unemployment compensation, was given that based upon his affidavit that he filed with the Texas Employment Commission that he was willing and able to work. Thereafter, when those payments and the compensation payments are
How is this relevant to the issue before us?
Well, it is, Your Honor, because
he has cross points.
I have cross points before the court, but it also comes into play with regard to Mr. Cornett's argument as to the cumulative effect of testimony of some of the later witnesses, because to receive the compensation, he has to fill out an affidavit on the form that says he is able and willing to work. The testimony is what would be controverted later by some of the witnesses Mr. Cornett put on.
We're only talking about Dr. Emmett and Mr. Milford.
Your Honor, I think that's incorrect. I think that there are four witnesses that should have been excluded, and the Texarkana court is wrong.
You'd waive your objections.
Yes, sir. There was a motion to exclude Dr. Emmett, Dr. Wood, Mrs. Cunningham, the man's niece, man's aunt, and Mr. Milford that was made to the court and ruled on, I think it's at page 8 in the statement of facts, where the court clearly ruled on that motion and overruled. And under the rules of evidence, Rule 103 says that where you've obtained an evidentiary ruling on evidence outside the presence of the jury, that preserves your point of error, or preserves your objection at the time that offer is made without necessity of making further objection. So I think that the court is wrong in Texarkana when they don't say that all four of these witnesses should have been excluded. The other facts that are relevant to this case, the suit was filed in January of 1986 alleging a general injury. The pleadings at that time did not say extend to an effect as they were later amended after the evidence had been put on. We went to trial in this case in December with those pleadings being lied, that it was a general injury. Prior to jury selection, I filed a motion in limine. One of the points of that motion in limine was to exclude all witnesses from testifying who had not been named in response to interrogatories, both expert and fact witnesses. I also, out of an abundance of precaution, filed a motion titled Motion to Exclude Evidence under Rule 215, Section 5. There were rulings on both of those motions made prior to jury selection. We went to trial. The evidence was put on after the plaintiff arrested, or before he arrested, but after he put on his evidence, he offered a trial amendment at that time to amend his pleadings, make this a case involving one where a specific injury extended to and affected the body generally, thereby causing total disability, only after the evidence had been put on. In light of those facts, I think, based upon what Mr. Cornett has said today, that there is no question that Rule 215 applies. under this court's rulings in the Morrow case, in the Yeldale versus Holiday Hills case, in the Youngblood case, the Gutierrez case, it is an automatic exclusion for failure to supplement. The only way out is for the offering party to go forward with their burden of proof as outlined in those cases and put on evidence of good cause.
And we've never specifically held, we've never addressed harmless error, have we, in any of those four cases?
No, sir. You have not.
If it was raised in the briefs, or?
I don't know if it was in the briefs of those cases.
But it's not something where we foreclosed it and said that this is error which cannot be cured. I mean, we've just been silent on that. So this is truly an open question, at least to a principle of law.
The Gutierrez, there was only one witness on attorney's fee, and that was a lawyer, and he had not been previously identified. Absent that testimony, excuse me, I said Gutierrez, I mean
Youngblood.
So obviously there it was harmful. And Yeldell, I think we were dealing with another nurse who witnessed the accident.
Dietitian.
And Mara, of course, we were dealing with the HEB store manager.
And Gutierrez is dealing with the doctor,
right.
Dr. Krellitz, who hadn't been named.
So really, we never had to address the question of harmless error in there, because in each of those instances, it was testimony that was not cumulative or added to by anybody else's testimony. Are you familiar with Walsh versus Mullane that's cited in the opinion?
Yes, sir.
In Walsh versus Mullane, where the plaintiff's sister is permitted to testify, the Houston First Court goes at length to point out that her testimony was not cumulative, but rather it introduced only evidence on certain points. I mean, she was a grunt and groan witness, but it was court observed powerful testimony. Reading in between the lines in Walsh versus Mullane, do you think they're hinting there that this was harmful error to allow the testimony?
Yes, Your Honor, I think so. Back to the original question about whether or not it had been discussed in these four previous cases, it has not. Judge Grant, in his dissenting opinion in motion rehearing here, cites Gutierrez as if there is some standard by which you're supposed to measure this evidence and its harmful effect. I would submit to the court that you have taken care of that by the promulgation of Rule 81 in the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure with regard to reversal in civil cases, which sets down the test for reversal in cases involving error. The harmful error test, it was taken over from Rule 434 in the old rules. Basically, under that, you have to prove two things to get a reversal. You have to prove that there was, in fact, an error of law, which there would have been by allowing these people to testify. And second, that error was calculated to and, in fact, caused the rendition of an improper verdict. That's essentially the test that's been set down by this court. I'm kind of skipping ahead of myself a little bit.
But you accept that burden?
Yes.
So we don't have any... We don't have any debate on the legal standard, then.
I don't think so.
Okay,
that
makes it easier.
I think the question to this court is whether it's going to go behind the application of that standard by the Court of Appeals, because that's the standard they used in reviewing the evidence in this case in making their determination that it was harmful error. So I don't think there is a question of the legal standard.
See, Cornelius didn't find harmful error. Cornelius based it... It was automatic exclusion, therefore it was error.
That's how he found the first prong of the test.
Correct, and the proponents of the witnesses did not discharge their burden of showing good cause. And that was the basis of Cornelius' opinion, as I understand it.
Partially, Your Honor. That was getting to the first prong of his discussion of the evidence itself. He had to get to that point before he could even talk about harmful error, because if the court had found good cause, the admission could not have been error. So Judge Cornelius' decision rests on two prongs under Rule 81 as he outlined. One was finding that error by the trial court. The second was whether that error or the admission of this testimony was harmful or caused the rendition of an improper verdict.
Page 4, he says, was not harmless error. Is that what you're referring to?
We conclude that the admission of his testimony was not harmless error in reference to Dr. Emmett. First full paragraph on page 4 of the slip.
Correct. Yes, sir. He concludes that it was not harmless error. It was harmful error, I guess, is the opposite of that. He does that by reviewing the evidence and applying, if you'll note, he in fact quotes Rule 81 as the standard that they're applying in this case, which I contend is the applicable standard. I think that either this court's got to change that standard or they're going to have to go back behind his decision and review the evidentiary factors in this case and say he was wrong in the way the Court of Appeals looked at it.
All right, well, just for the purposes of discussion, let's assume that we adopt the position that both counsel have here. I don't think we're required to, but let's go through each of the four witnesses.
Okay.
Mr. Carnett points out, and I think it is a question that has vexed some attorneys, what if you've already taken a deposition? Are we going to exalt form over substance to the extent that if your witness to deposition has been taken, you have to listen to the interrogatory?
This rule presents a big problem to folks who practice in East Texas. I'll just
does all over the state.
In Lamar County,
we created a monster here. We were trying to get rid of game playing. The rest of the court was. I wasn't here. There seems to be another set of games that have come up.
One of the problems that arise, and I don't remember in this particular case when we were notified it was going to go to trial, but typically in Lamar County, you get your notice that pretrial is going to be on X day about 2 weeks before pretrial. Trial starts the Tuesday following pretrial. So you have about 2 weeks notice that you're going to trial. So you don't have the luxury of being able to go back and review your file timely, because even if you look at it when you know you're going to trial, you're already in trouble. That's a problem.
How do we handle the problem Chief Justice raised?
Where the witness has been deposed?
Why we have Rule 215-5 and its predecessor rules. It's stop gamesmanship, and it's also to prevent you from having to go into court not knowing what your adversary is going to say. With the idea being that if everybody knows everyone's hold card, then maybe we can get a settlement on these cases. If you've taken a deposition and know what the doctor is going to say, do you think that satisfies the reason for the adoption of the rule?
Depending on the facts of the case, that in this particular case, I don't think so. Generally, I think your observation is correct that that would satisfy the purpose of the rule.
What makes this case different?
In this particular case, the allegation was a general injury. I took Dr. Emmett's deposition to determine if there was in fact a general injury. When asked specific questions about it, he wouldn't venture an opinion.
He said he wasn't qualified.
That's right.
Well, how about the three of the witnesses? Isn't that the bias also?
Let's finish the doctor first.
So, with regard to the pleadings that were on file at the time we went to trial, there was no reason to call Dr. Emmett. Dr. Emmett, to testify in his expert capacity, what he testified about essentially enhanced the testimony of the other witnesses. He testified that...
was he called line of trial? No. The plaintiff just called him by the deposition that you'd already taken?
Yes, read the deposition.
Your question.
He read mine and his questions on cross.
You got the option of introducing the rest of it.
I introduced portions of it. Without waiving my objections, I went ahead and introduced portions of it to rebut what the plaintiff had introduced.
And this was after the trial, wasn't it?
No, this was before. He testified that Dr. Jackson was one of the better orthopedic surgeons that he knew to bolster her testimony. He testified that the plaintiff was always truthful and honest, to bolster his testimony. He testified...
I said he. Who are you talking
about? Dr. Emmett.
All right.
He testified that the plaintiff was not malingering in those specific words. And he was the only independent witness. And by independent, I'm not counting Dr. Ruth Jackson, who was a paid expert, and I'm not counting the plaintiff. But he was the only independent witness that testified that the man was totally and permanently disabled in response to a hypothetical question by Mr. Cornett.
But he would not testify as a general injury.
No, sir.
Which is the, was the key to this case.
Yes, sir. I think at the trial court level, the trial court's thinking was that an extension injury is the same as a general injury. Ultimately, the possible outcome it is, but in the way the case is handled, there's a great difference.
Yeah, but as a practical matter, the insurance company paid him for his leg.
Yes, sir.
If Mr. Carnett had not been able to extend it into a general injury, the ball game would have been over and you'd owe $0.
With one exception, Dr. Jackson testified that he had a bulging disc in his back, which is a general injury. That's not an extension injury. And that was the testimony from her that we go to trial with.
So you thought you were trying to back it?
Never mind. To be honest with the court, I suspected at some point that he was going to have to amend his pleadings because the condition of the evidence when we went to trial, he could not prove general injury.
Are you going to discuss the other witnesses that you claim or should have been excluded?
Mr. Milford, the plaintiff's uncle, he was the only witness that testified that the plaintiff complained on the day that he was hurt about his back, and that he had continued to complain since that time about his back hurting. He also testified, again, that the boy was, I think his words were, the boy is worthless, and he can't work anymore now, to bolster the testimony of the other witnesses. Mrs. Cunningham, the boy's aunt that testified, she testified
now,
that...
Now, wait a minute. Let's back up. Why was Milford harmful?
Because he tied back pain back to the injury itself. He's the most specific testimony in that regard.
Well, Mrs. What about Dr. Jackson? Was a hypothetical question given to her? Or was she allowed to repeat history? And was the history given to her by G, back injury?
The testimony that was given by Dr. Jackson was she was given a hypothetical. She examined the plaintiff one time, testified she didn't plan on seeing him before or again. She testified that he had an injury to his leg, and then in response to a hypothetical question from the plaintiff's counsel, which included, as I recall, I believe in my brief I counted them, the mention of back pain 6 or 8 times in that hypothetical, that he had received an injury that extended to and affected his body due to the ligamentous strain, I believe was her word, from the described injury.
Back?
To his back. That was her testimony. That's why it was crucial from the defense of this case that there not be back pain tied back to the time of the injury, because the basis for the hypothetical question would fall at that point. Mrs. Cunningham testified that in her exact words, I believe are quoted in my brief, but she said that in the weeks and months that followed her first visit in April, he walked with a limp and he seemed to wince a lot, and she thought he was having back pain. So once again, her testimony is harmful because it ties back pain back to the leg injury. Dr. Wood was the boy's treating physician. He testified that what I would consider favorably to my case, that the boy had never complained of back pain, that in fact, as far as he knew, any disability was due to the leg. What happened is the plaintiff took his deposition, took the cross-examination, put on testimony before the jury that Dr. Wood treats lots of people from Campbell Soup, that Liberty Mutual is the workers' compensation carrier for Campbell Soup, and impeached his credibility in that manner prior to him even being able to give his opinion. And I contend that was harmful because it doesn't do any good to put your witness on when he's already been blown out of the water by impeachment testimony. And that was the harmful effect of the portions that were offered from Dr. Wood's testimony. Now, I'll concede to the court I was going to use Dr. Wood's testimony in my portion of the case. But it was used, the portions with regard to impeaching him were used prior to any of the other portions of his deposition. Those are the portions of the evidence that was admitted by the court that were harmful.
What was the interrogatory that you sent to Mr. Carnett that would have covered the lay witnesses?
There are specifically two of interrogatories in question here. One was for expert witnesses.
Right.
One was for persons with knowledge of relevant facts. It's taken out of the definition given in the rule for identifying witnesses.
Okay.
I don't have it at my fingertips, but
it would be your contention that Milford and Cunningham would fall into the category of persons having knowledge of relevant facts.
Yes, Your Honor. They have knowledge of the man's condition before the injury and after the injury, and complaints in between. That's
he wasn't tied to relevant facts of the injury.
Of the injury itself, how it happened? No.
I've seen that error made before.
Now,
the question asked only people who know about how the injury occurred, and then the
I don't want to, without having it here to look at, I don't want to represent the court that that's not it.
We'll look at it.
But I believe that it has to acknowledge relevant facts of the incident alleged herein or something.
Well, if it's
I'm
the
not
incident
sure.
alleged herein, that wouldn't exclude testimony about.
I would recommend the court look at that particular interrogatory because I don't want to represent what it says. But that's the evidence that the court allowed in that was cumulative, or is claimed to be cumulative by the plaintiffs. Yet that harmful effect is what changed the case. After the introduction of this is when he went back and made the trial amendment, was granted that by the judge over my objection, and we've gone from a general back injury type case to an extension injury. And ultimately the jury found that extension injury and awarded the plaintiff total and permanent incapacity. As I see it, this court has kind of put lawyers in a box at the trial level, because in this case we're in a position where, having strictly followed the rules, there may be injustice done. I'm not going to represent to the court that they can reach a fair decision under the rules in this case. I see the court having maybe three options in this case. One, go back and revise the application of Morrow in Rule 215 so that it's more lax, takes into account the actual practice out in the hinterlands, out in Lamar County, Bowie County, and say that it's not absolute, it's not automatic.
Do you think we should require 30 days notice of trial date if we keep the rule like it is?
That I don't think is practical either. Without speaking for the clerks and the judges, I think that where you've got judges that are riding circuit, that may not be practical. And we, up in our portion of state, have a lot of judges ride circuit. Judge Thompson, who tried this case, ride circuit. So that may be a problem. But this court has to either revise that rule. They have to either, if they don't do that, they have to change the standard by which you judge harmful error and go back and revise Rule 81, the Rules of Appellate Procedure. Or they're left with the alternative under the rules the way they are, is to affirm the trial, the finding of the appellate court, and send this back for retrial.
First case written on the new rule, 215, what was then 215-5, was a rushing case written by Judge Keith after the amendments to the 81 rules. In that, he utilizes an abuse of discretion standard. And then we came along in 84 and again in 88, and with our opinions in Morrow and Galdell, really took it out of an abuse of discretion standard and just made it an absolute standard. Do you think if we went back and said that we judge the trial judge on abuse of discretion, that would be more workable out in the hinterlands?
Well, as I heard referenced earlier, that kind of puts folks, the trial lawyer, on the horns of a dilemma. Because if it's absolute, you know where you stand. If it's abuse of discretion, it will be almost impossible to conceive a situation where it would not be an abuse, where it would be an abuse of discretion to allow the evidence in. Are you going to draw the line at mistakes by attorneys? Are you going to draw the line at incomplete evidence from clients to attorneys in answering? Forgetfulness of secretaries? There are just an innumerable reasons that could be given for failure to supplement. So it's a problem, because I don't think the absolute rule is workable, but I also don't think the use of discretion rule is fair, and it doesn't achieve the ends that this court has sought in controlling discovery.
Well, if you can help us on a better rule, we're grappling, I'll tell you.
Well, as I was preparing for this argument, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, because I think in applying the rules as they are, I win the case, but I don't think that's fair, to be honest with the court. The way the rules...
We appreciate your dedication to probably your client's broader interest in a thousand other trials they'll have.
Well,
rather than coming in here and insisting that we follow a rule that does seem to be causing problems all over the state.
It's an unfair rule in application.
How does the present rule, how is it causing problems in the context of this particular case? We've got Yandell, we've got Morrow, they said automatic exclusion. Everybody knows who has the burden. It was the party.
He got a trial notice 16 days after he was supposed to have all this stuff lined up.
You got short notice of trial. Plus,
How did the short notice affect you?
Well, because at that time, if he were to name his witnesses, he's already within the 30 days under the rule, and they're automatically excluded. And I don't blame Mr. Cornett in this case for relying on the fact that the deposition had been taken. I mean,
If you follow the rule, you would ask for continuous to do it right. Everybody knows who's got the burden. So you don't go to trial that week. You can postpone it for another 30 days. At least everybody knows who's accountable and who isn't.
I think the presiding judge is not going to be back for a while.
I think that presents an ethical problem for the lawyer.
And in Gutierrez, we condemn continuances in the face of discovery matters.
So it really presents a problem.
So you're saying... for this court to withdraw what we said in Yandell and Morrow and say we said automatic exclusion, but we really didn't mean that.
Well, I don't hearken back to the days of trial by ambush unless I've got the ammunition. And that's effectively if you go back and remove Morrow and Rule 215, that's basically where you end up. So I don't think the court should do that. But then again. There's got to be some constraint.
And what is? I mean, you give us your best thinking on it. You've got the power to undo what we've done. How would you undo it?
Well, like you're asking me to write the opinion against myself. It sounds. I would think that a application of the rule that's not absolute, but is not a discretionary standard.
There's got to be one or the other.
Which is a problem. There, you can't apply this rule across the board as an absolute standard. So I would think that the court would need to set up guidelines or shorten the time they present the solution. Because
we just lengthened it from 14 days in 81, we went to 30 days in 84.
And, Your Honor, I think in response to that, you've noticed the increase in caseload because of problems like this.
This is probably close to 10% of the cases.
Well, as a practicing trial lawyer, it presents a lot of problems. Yesterday, as I was preparing to fly down here, I got a trial notice, picked up my interrogatories, and looked, and I'm out of time. I'm in the exact same situation Mr. Cornett's in. And I don't think I was not diligent in that case. It was a doctor who performed an independent medical evaluation. But I'm not going to be able to use him unless I can convince the court that I've got good cause. And my only good cause is, gosh, Judge, if I'd known I was going to get set to trial, I'd have done this, or if I'd remembered I hadn't named him, I'd have done it. So it is a big problem out there. And the practical realities are that in counties where pretrial is 10 days prior to the time you go to trial, a 7-day limit would not be unreasonable, because you know what pretrial is when you're going to trial.
Don't we have a problem with there's two kinds of cases? There are big cases with multiple parties that have 40 or 50 witnesses, in which 30 days may not even be enough.
And they name everybody from the beginning.
Have 40 or 50 witnesses, in which 30 days may not even be enough.
And they name everybody from the beginning.
And then there are cases where you just have one witness on each side, and you could do it with 7 days.
Well, in the typical workers' compensation case, the file comes in, they send interrogatories, I send interrogatories, we answer them within 45, 50 days of the time the case is filed. Then it rocks on until it hits the top of the docket and you go to trial.
So we've got to write rules that apply to a complex case. Mm-hmm. where if you drop, you know, the name 30 days before trial, if you drop the names of 50 expert witnesses, your client could almost sue you for malpractice for not wanting to take their deposition.
I agree.
30 days wouldn't be enough time.
I agree.
On the other hand, in this case, 7 days would have allowed you to get everything in order.
I think the problem is if we have a hard and fast rule like that, we're going to have to suffer some instances of injustice like this case.
Would surprise be a criteria?
Well, this court has held that surprise is good cause for not for excluding the evidence, but not for inclusion. So that's a problem. Even as recently, Judge Keltner wrote an opinion in the Braniff versus Levitz case where there appeared to not even be a ruling. And if you read the rule the way it's written, that there doesn't even have to be a ruling on the objection in order to have the evidence excluded. I mean, the way that this court's written the Morrow opinion and its follow-up opinions from that, it is automatic, absent even an objection. So it's a problem.
We appreciate your thoughts.
If there are any questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Otherwise, I'll await your opinion. Thank you.
Well, I think Mr. Mercer and I have defined the problem that the court's going to have, all right. Let me, in 2 minutes, I'm going to try to let the court out for my allotted time. He brought up a point, and I really don't think it's one of the material matter, but let me briefly touch on it. He said that the injury to the leg extended into and affected the body generally wasn't before the court until the testimony had been completed. Now let me briefly address that fact. I amended my claim before the Industrial Action Board, before the board ruled, to extend and affect the body generally. Then, in Dr. Jackson's deposition, several months before the trial, that specific question was asked. Then it was asked several weeks before the trial in Dr. Emmett's deposition. And then, on voir dire of the jury, in my first presentation of the case to the jury, I told the jury that we were going to try to extend the injury into and affect the body generally. That's when Mr. Mercer objected that it was not in the pleading. I asked the court at that time to let me amend my pleading, and the court orally agreed to do that. Then the formal amendment was not filed, admittedly, as Mr. Mercer says, until maybe, my recollection is not too good on this, but maybe at the conclusion of the testimony. But Mr. Mercer in no way was surprised at my contention on that. I'm sorry?
Did he ever move for a continuance at any point?
Did he? No, sir, he did not.
Let me...
That's not a point that's even being preserved. We're just...
You, in your opening statement, put great stress on the harmless error aspect of the case. What do you say in light of the fact that Mr. Mercy gets up and says, yes, he'll accept that standard, but there was harmful error in the case, and he cites as to what Judge Carneas has written here in his opinion. How do you respond to what Judge Carneas says about Dr. Emmett's testimony being harmful?
I respond, Judge Kilgarland, by my previous argument, a part of it was that Dr. Emmett, on the crucial issue in this case as to whether or not the injury to the leg extended to and affected the body generally, Dr. Emmett refused to go along with that. So on that crucial issue, my contention is that, and Mr. Mercer argued this to the jury, and the jury surely could have considered, well, listen, I don't believe that because his family doctor wouldn't go along with it. So my contention is that it was more harm to me on that issue than it was helpful. And
well, help clear this up. Judge Carnea says that Dr. Emmett's testimony further substantiated the issues, specifically the extension of pain to the back from the leg injury. And yet you're telling, is Judge Carnea wrong? Because you've been saying that Dr. Emmett did not support this theory.
That's right, exactly. Judge Carnea is wrong in his interpretation of the evidence. Now then, Mr. Mercer pointed out very forcibly in his argument and in his brief that Dr. Emmett says that Mr. G did not complain of back pain until 1985. Again, that hurt me. Mr. G had already testified, yeah, I told the doctor that I had back pain, and I had back pain shortly after this happened, and I've got back pain now, and every time I'd go back to work at light duty, he went back twice, as I recall the record, light duty to work, said I couldn't work because my back and my leg bothered me. So, my contention is that when Dr. Emmett said he didn't even mention back pain to me until 1985, that again hurt my case. And yet, the jury, in their infinite wisdom, chose to go along with my contention that he did have back pain and it extended into his body. I found one case, and I have not briefed it. I want to call it to the attention of the court. It came to my attention after my brief was in. But here is one case by the Court of Civil Appeals in Corpus Christi, which discusses Yandell and Mara, where the it's Ramos versus Champlain Petroleum Company, and I don't have the writ history, but rehearing was denied on May 26, 1988, 750 Southwestern 2nd, 873, in which the party did not list the names of witnesses in its interrogatories. And this court, which is what I'm pleading for this court to do, says that even though Rule 215.5 was violated, still, it was cumulative evidence. That's the only case that I can call to the attention of the court at this time where that specific, and as I say, I don't have the writ history on that case. But again, I appreciate very much appearing before this body. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the business of the court for the day. The foregoing cases will be submitted on oral argument and written briefs.
The audience will please rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned, subject to call.